then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's Thanksgiving Day, November the 28th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. All right, the first thing I want to do is welcome two new arrivals here in the homeland, one in the Puget Sound area and a second in Boise, Idaho. Welcome home, guys. People, it is, in fact, happening. It's simply happening way, way too slow. Now, there seems to be a growing consensus, and I'm not just talking about in our own little tiny internet community, that the year 2014 may be it, 100 years after the beginning of World War I, appropriately enough, when the last world that we ruled ended. End of the line. Now, I'll get into that later on down the road when things become a little bit more clear, but honestly, the impression I get is that we've all kind of agreed to try and settle back and have one last good Christmas, after which all hell will break loose in the new year. Now, beginning in January, when an estimated 80 million Americans will lose their health care coverage and be thrown onto Obamacare, that's when the employer cancellations will begin. Not to mention the full-time employees at minimum wage who will be knocked back to 29.5 hours per week so that the employer doesn't have to deal with Obamacare at all. And by the way, the website still doesn't work. Another housekeeping item. We now have many thousands of new business cards thanks to one of our female comrades in Oregon. She knows who she is, and thank you very much. Any of you guys out there who need some for distribution in your areas, let me know. Email me at nwnet@earthlink.net. I would frankly prefer that most of these new cards be distributed here in the homeland states of Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Montana. Housekeeping again. Guys, make sure you keep your mailing address current for your Northwest Observers and your organizational letters and the other stuff that I send out in the mail. I had a Freedom Sons returned to me recently by the post office because a guy neglected to inform me of an address change, and it was a $12.35 priority mail package. A penny saved is a penny earned, guys. I hate wasting postage because it's one of our biggest expenses. Now, on a more serious note, I normally don't like to just sit here and read out things that I've already published on the internet, but this is an extremely important topic, and I want not only to publish it in print, but I want to make an audio presentation so that those of you who are so inclined to make YouTube videos for us, and there are some of you still, you will have a recording of this material. As you'll see, there may come a time in the future when an audio recording of my comments on this subject may prove to be prescient and of historical interest, if nothing else. This was originally published on the Thought Crime blog several days ago. I've been informed that Bill White has been interrogated in his cell about me in this blog. His captors have demanded, among other things, to know if I am paying him for his material, which would be a violation of Bureau of Prison Regulations. In point of fact, no, I am not paying him. I am publishing Bill White's letters and writings for one primary reason. The dictatorship does not want you to hear what he has to say, and therefore it behooves us all to hear it. Anything which Barack Hussein Obama and his servants don't want us to do, say, hear, or think is something that, by definition, any man of integrity should be doing, saying, hearing, and thinking. For reasons which I still find somewhat puzzling, someone in the regime, in the absurdly misnamed Justice Department or elsewhere, has developed an obsession bordering on insanity with Bill White, even though they have to know that he is completely harmless. Even federal employees can't possibly be stupid enough or hysterical enough to believe their own propaganda, at least not in this instance. White's actual written work these days has lapsed into mysticism and obscure historical analysis, which is of no interest except to a small group of scholars. The average skinhead couldn't possibly understand it. Hell, the average skinhead probably couldn't even read it. The idea that Bill White is some kind of revolutionary firebrand who, if released, will leap up onto an outdoor cafe table and incite a mob with pitchforks and torches to storm the Bastille, a la Camille de Moulin, is farcical. They have to know this full well, and yet they persist in indicting him time and time again on a series of charges, growing more and more grotesque and outlandish every time, which makes one wonder if Monty Python isn't writing the script. They are willing to expend hundreds of thousands and, if necessary, millions of taxpayer dollars over a period of years, keeping him bunged up in a cell and fabricating non-existent crimes in order to immure this man in prison for the rest of his life, which is clearly what they're aiming for. Even the people who are torturing him admit that Bill White has never committed one single overt criminal or violent act. He has been held in prison almost 5 years so far, solely for things he posted to the internet, for God's sake, including one email which the regime's own technical expert informed them before the trial that he did not send and could not have sent, and which was apparently, in fact, sent by their own star witness against him. If I understand correctly, this was done while in the company of United States Marshals. There simply doesn't seem to be any feasible motive for keeping Bill White in prison beyond bizarre, deranged personal malice on someone's part, given the opaque and Byzantine nature of our lords and masters' inner workings. It is unlikely that we'll ever know who's behind this lunatic persecution, nor is there anything anyone can do about it. We now live in a third world country where the ruling party does whatever the fuck it wants, to whomever it wants, and there is no accountability of any kind. But I can and will deny the dictatorship what appears to be its primary goal, which is to make Bill White shut up. So long as I am around and have internet access, and so long as Bill is not locked up incommunicado or murdered in prison, he will share whatever voice I have. It's not much, but it's his as long as he needs it. And yes, I know that may not be long. Now, let's talk about the threats made against me. I could go off onto a long First Amendment philippic here, but if the United States Constitution meant anything to you buzzcut booyahs and bitches in Hillary pants suits, you wouldn't be doing what you're doing, which is taking money and Obamacare-free health insurance from an uncouth third-world despot in order to evade that very Constitution and to do harm to the innocent like Bill White. So I'll make it nice and simple for you. Guys and gals, it's like this. Several months ago, I turned 60 years of age. That's 6 whole decades that you can never take away from me. Not very pleasant decades, most of them. Life has not been a bowl of Skittles for me, and your colleagues of yesteryear had a lot to do with that. But those years are mine now. I have lived them, and you cannot have them. As I like to say sometimes, you can't take my youth. I've already misspent it. Yes, I know that won't deter you. I know some of you get your rocks off by arresting elderly white men on fabricated charges and sending them to die in the hells that you and your kind have created for those of us who refuse to bow down. Edgar Steele, Bob Chambliss, Byron Delabecquith, J.B. Stoner, others. I knew some of them. I know that you delight in nothing more than a weak and helpless victim who can no longer fight back, even if he has the will to do so. In fact, you prefer it. Yes, I know you can get me anytime you want. I don't break the law, but that no longer matters. When the spirit finally moves you, you will simply make something up. My goal in that matter is to try and get you guys to prefer the real charges when you come for me, i.e. that I wrote or said something that the dictator or his claque didn't like. But as the Bill White case itself demonstrates, that's unlikely. Yes, I know you can destroy me, and there is a good chance that you will. Do you seriously think that if I were unwilling to accept that, I would be doing what I'm doing or living like I'm living? Two, I'd rather not die on the floor of whatever concrete box you throw me into, and for that reason, I do take certain precautions, like not breaking the law. With that and $1.50, I can buy a small cup of watery coffee at McDonald's. What you do doesn't matter anymore, or even who you are. It's who some asshole in a suit or some political gangster in a black robe says you are. Ask Bill White.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. I'm going to wrap up my white character series today since it's gone on long enough. There's not much to step four, which gives me an opportunity to recap why I structured my white character material the way I have. I've been made aware that I'm not always as clear as I need to be. I've gone over my presentations on the subject of white character as well as other previous talks, and I'm forced to admit that criticism is, to a certain degree, valid. I've got no chance today of clearing everything up, but I can at least try to set the record straight with white character. Step four is basically do it. You've already decided what you want, figured out what needs to change, and dealt with any impediments, so you ought to be good to go. For your individual migration, this means coming home. In the case of the Northwest American Republic, this would be actually confronting the occupying powers and forcing them out of our country. That would be the only thing left to do since the party will have set its goal, set out on the path to reach that goal, and done footwork to prepare for it, just like each migrant will have done. There's nothing really fancy about that, and it's that way for a reason. When I first started the white character material, I mentioned that the abstract process I'm outlining is exactly the same for solving any problem, racial or not. It's not especially profound or complicated, and it certainly isn't anything you haven't run into before. Why, then, would I go about things this way? Firstly, because I know I've been far too vague in the past, and I really wanted this subject to be as literal as possible. Secondly, I didn't want it to be overly complicated, because that would send some of you, who, to be fair, are genuinely trying to make their migrations, down the rabbit hole of trying to interpret something needlessly cryptic. That would be the exact opposite of what I'm trying to achieve, because white character is something you have to do and not just think about. With all that out of the way, I need to address exactly why I chose the steps I chose, since that, unlike the big picture, is not immediately obvious. The problem of white character requires that modern white people, as the party puts it, become men and women our great-grandparents would recognize. To make that more tangible, our great-grandparents, were they in our situation, would not accept the failure of our movement and would certainly take whatever steps necessary to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. It's not my purpose today to go through a long, drawn-out, compelling justification of the Northwest Imperative, but it won't hurt for me to demonstrate the correctness of the material I'm explaining. Among those calling themselves white nationalists, there is a limitless supply of so-called plans which their proponents recommend. The trouble with all but one of these plans is that they're of no effect, debilitating to their participants, or otherwise anti-solutions. White character step one requires an objective to be set. But what are the objectives of the white nationalist movement? Some of us think voting the right way can end white genocide. Others think running off into rural environments and building compounds will ward off racial destruction. Some of us attempt to get white nationalists to associate with one another and set up what they think are white enclaves where white people can magically escape any sort of non-white danger. Are any of these things correct? Will they actually solve the problem for us? While certain aspects of these things may be desirable in their own right, do any of them actually alter some facet of our problem? The obvious answer is no. Each of these possible courses of action can, at first, seem like a step towards the realization of the 14 words. Conversely, each of them lacks one or more aspects of the Northwest Imperative, which is the plan to seize state power in the Pacific Northwest and create a place where our race may raise new generations in safety and moral security, without the threat of Jewish societal perversion and harm by non-whites. The Northwest Imperative, which seeks to promote and implement the Butler Plan, is the only true objective the white nationalist movement has offered anyone in decades. Those opposing it have no viable alternative. The closest the rest of the movement will ever come, aside from shouting at the world about completely obvious racial facts, is to command vague demonstrations of racial solidarity without ever going anywhere near a tangible goal. When considering a course of action, the reason behind it must always be questioned and vetted. When a particular goal is obtained, how will that be determined and what will be different afterward? If someone offering you racial guidance or instruction can't answer that question, they don't deserve your attention. If you are unable to justify your own behavior by this standard, you ought to be very, very concerned. Setting off on something you shouldn't be involved in isn't any way to save our race. After setting an objective in step one, I asked listeners to perform an unbiased examination of themselves compared against the sort of person it would take to accomplish their objective when I outlined step two. This, as far as I can figure, is where I lost most people, since this involves acknowledging whatever needs to change about themselves and their situation, regardless of their intended objective. The core of the white character problem is this. We've started to think we're above criticism, which means we think we're above changing ourselves to conform with outside circumstances which require things of us. Almost all of the racial content on the internet is some variety of whining about what other white people need to do. I noticed that, unlike the Northwest migrants, the online whiners aren't willing to perform the task they demand of others. Let's get this clear right now in order to sum up the white character situation. The way most white nationalists act and expect others to act indicates to me they believe that the race is here in order to make their American dream come true. In reality, we're each here for the sake of the race and not the other way around. Until we learn that, we're going to wallow in failure and false starts. Most white nationalists never get past the point of expecting the movement to make their individual racial problems go away and give them back the American dream they want so badly. But whatever happened to the American dream anyway? Unfortunately for us, the American dream came true. There are a number of ways to view any historic event, and as it turns out, one could categorize the American Revolution as an effort to run away from paying the British back for a very expensive war. In hindsight, the British weren't being unreasonable by asking for payment for that war which, by some accounts, the colonists started. The American dream has always been about running away from obligations, and that being the case, the American dream has come true for all of us, especially white nationalists. We're living in the world we created. In truth, we have no right to be upset when we continue to pretend we're entitled to anything different. Part of changing yourself, especially in conjunction with accomplishing a goal, is becoming a person capable of completing that goal. If we would stop running away from hard things, we could actually become capable of and earn the right to create a new world where our racial extinction isn't an imminent event. No other white nationalist effort exists with this objective in mind, and refusing to participate is nothing more than indulging in the American tendency to run away from problems. Hail victory, comrades.
I think I should point out that Andy has been very hampered in discussing the issue of white character, as I myself am always hampered, by what might be called the unspoken prime directive. You can discuss movement character issues in the abstract, because the issue is by now so obvious a factor in our failure that we pretty much can't avoid it, but you must never name names or discuss specific incidents. That is a sin against something called white unity. White unity is something like a unicorn. It is a mythological animal, and it doesn't really exist. I know, I've violated that rule a couple of times myself recently, as when I referred to the Craig Cobb fiasco in last week's podcast, but when someone pulls a play as boneheaded as Cobb, I think not saying anything would be just fatuous. Come on, guys, it's time we at least made some attempt to live in the real world. Part of that is learning to have open and honest discussions of the things that we need to be talking about. And one of the primary things every white nationalist needs to be talking about openly and honestly is why there is no bona fide white resistance movement, and there hasn't been for the past 60 years. Anyway, the Romanian Iron Guard music I played last week was very well received. Like me, most of us hadn't ever heard any Romanian fascist vibes before. So here's another piece our Romanian comrades sent us from the 1940s called To Battle Workers, which, despite the title, is in fact a right-wing rather than a commie song. Like Lord Lucan said last week, always remember that National Socialism and Fascism were in fact genuine working class movements.
Yeah.
Next up, I'm going to play for you the last installment of Dr. Revelo Pendleton Oliver's famous speech called Conspiracy or Degeneracy, which was delivered to the John Birch Society National Convention in July of 1966. If there's any interest, I will make the entire hour-long speech available to anyone who wants to get it. I'll probably have to upload it to sendspace.com or something like that, but if you want to just sit down and listen to it from beginning to end, I'll lay the file on you.
Despite the restraints placed on scientific investigation by liberal intellectuals and the like, and despite the awesome complexity of genetic factors in so complicated a creature as man, it is now virtually certain that all of the physiological structure of human beings, including such details as color of eyes, acuity of vision, stature, susceptibility to specific diseases, and formation of the brain, are genetically determined beyond possibility of modification or alteration, except by physical injury or chemical damage. It is far more difficult to investigate intellectual and moral capacities, but all of the evidence thus far available indicates that intelligence and probably moral instincts are as completely and unalterably determined by genetic inheritance as physical traits. Many persons find the conclusions thus suggested unpleasant, just as all of us, I am sure, would be much happier if the earth were the immobile center of the universe and the heavens revolved about it. But although vast areas in the new science remain unexplored, the principles of heredity have been determined with a fairly high degree of scientific probability, and they are furthermore in accord with what common sense has always told us, and also with that rational perception of our place in the universe that underlies religion. We can blind children, but we cannot give them sight. We can stunt and debauch their minds in progressive schools, but we cannot give them intelligence they did not inherit at birth. It is likely that we can make criminals of them by putting them, like the somewhat improbable Oliver Twist, in Fagin's gang or its equivalent, but we cannot induce a moral sense in one who was born without it. We have always known that it is easy for man to destroy what he can never create. All men are created unequal, and there is nothing we can do about that. That is the law of life, and we had better recognize it. The Bolsheviks secretly understand and use the scientific knowledge they would conceal from us in the schools. Why do you suppose that most states now have legislation to subsidize and accelerate the breeding of bastards, of whom at least 95% are the offspring of the very dregs of the population, the shiftless, the irresponsible, the stupid, the degenerate? Why is so large a part of your income stolen by the federal government and devoted to the stimulation in every conceivable way of the hideous, fecundity of the unfit, the criminal, and the imbecile elements in our already excessive population? That is not merely to produce a voting majority of parasites, to keep gangs in power by majority rule. Figure it out genetically. There is another unpleasant fact, painful to the tender-minded, that you could deduce from the laws of heredity. It is also conclusively established by direct observation. A fact so obvious that rational men have always known it. And no one doubted it until Bolsheviks and liberals gained control of our schools and began to teach our children as impudent a falsehood as has ever been perpetuated. That is the natural and unalterable dissimilarity and therefore inequality of races. The observed differences, physical, mental, and instinctive, are in fact so great that the proponents of the doctrine of biological evolution have found it simply impossible to trace the five primary races back to a single human type. To account for the biological differences in evolutionary terms, it is necessary to assume the existence of five different species of pre-human anthropoids. To conclude, in other words, that racial differences antedate humanity and the earliest kind of life that can be called human. For the reasons why the observed differences are too great to permit the hypothesis of a single human ancestral type, I refer you to Professor Carlton S. Coon's The Origin of Races, first published in 1962. I have mentioned some of these biological realities of the world in which we live. They are doubtless regrettable, but they are unalterable. If you find them intolerable and unthinkable, the only thing that I can suggest is that you try to flag down a flying saucer and take passage for some other solar system. The one thing that we must not do is to follow the standard procedure of liberals. Imagine a nice dream world in which the laws of nature do not operate. And then, like children playing games in their nursery, pretend that we are living in it. Such infantilism is simply suicidal. At the risk of shocking you further, I shall point out that if we intend to survive, we shall have to do something to bring do-gooding under control. We now regard it, I know, as a kind of amiable weakness, something like alcoholism, and even take pride in some of its manifestations. When a puckish reporter in New York several years ago experimented by solemnly telling people with an unwinking stare that he was collecting money to buy clothes for Cinderella, he obtained, as I remember, about $140 in 2 hours. I suspect that most of us who saw his whimsical report felt a kind of satisfaction in it as a proof of our national generosity. We may not be very bright, but we sure got hearts of gold. But now those givers may have been foolish, but at least they were exercising the Christian virtue of charity, which, remember, is to give voluntarily of our own money and effort. The do-gooder is another species. He claims he wants to do good with other people's money, and often at the expense of other people's lives. Have you ever stopped to consider the enormous havoc and ruin that has been wrought in this world by earnest do-gooders? Often under stimulus from experts, to be sure, but earnest nevertheless. I know that Woodrow Wilson was a pliant tool in the hands of those who selected him and boosted him into the presidency, especially Colonel House and Jakob Schiff. But he is reported to have exclaimed before his death, "God forgive me, I have unwittingly ruined my country." If he felt that remorse, he cannot have been entirely cynical. He probably did have some of the characteristic hallucinations of do-gooders. He may actually have believed that there could be such a thing as a war to end wars, and thus make the world safe for democracy. If so, those figments of his imagination sent 115,000 of our best men to a useless death and inflicted on another 200,000 painful wounds, maiming many of them for life. Is that a proper price to ask a nation to pay just because some muzzy-headed dreamer feels an itch to save the world at our expense? Our history provides us with a far more terrible example. A strange breed that flourished other places, and especially here in New England a little more than a century ago. It was another grim appearance in history of the old illusions of Gnosticism. Whence came the Transcendentalists? Whence came the Abolitionists? Whence came the conspiracy of the Secret Six, as they called themselves? Who used as their instrument that distinguished horse thief and homicidal maniac, John Brown, whom liberals so much admire for his ferocity? We all know how much the Secret Six and their kind had to do with forcing on the South the desperate war for independence that ended so tragically for the South and eventually for the whole nation just a century ago. We all know the history of that bloody and terrible war, of the many battles that left whole countrysides drenched with the best blood of our race, of the almost unbelievable valor and courage shown on both sides. Now, I fully understand that throughout history, and especially perhaps in the United States, slavery has been a baneful and pernicious institution, most baneful indeed in its effect on the owners. I do have a deep sympathy and compassion for the Negroes. There were 4 million of them at that time in our land. They have since been so oppressed, you know, that there is a larger number. But I wonder whether anyone can read the history of that vast slaughter and ruin that has indelibly stained the pages of our history without asking himself whether that was not too great a price to pay. Bismarck was not a humanitarian and did not pretend to be one. But he once said, as a strictly practical matter, that a German colony in the South Seas was not worth the bones of one Prussian grenadier. And let our compassion for the slaves and our liking for their race be as great as you will, I can only marvel if any man can find it in his heart to say that their emancipation was worth the lives of just one company of men in any one of the regiments from Virginia or Minnesota than met at Shiloh, Chickamauga, or Gettysburg. No race could afford much do-gooding on that scale. There is another fact of life that everyone knows, but many people try to ignore, and that is the prevalence of innate evil in the human species, including, I am sorry to say, all races. If you are a Christian, you have divine authority for the perception of how terribly extensive and powerful in this world is the domain of evil, pure evil. If you are not, you must follow some doctrine of biological evolution, and you will find that the real mystery is how it happened that men, any men, became thoughtful and kind. Civilization is only a little more than 5,000 years, a mere moment in biological time. It is perfectly obvious that the genetic stock of every race must contain innumerable genes that persist from primeval savagery, and that even the most cultivated and refined society must produce beings whose lust for evil is doubtless stronger than any man's desire for good. Have you ever stopped to think what would happen in any city if the police were really as ineffectual as Earl Warren is trying to make them? Have you ever considered the biological source of the many crimes that are committed, even in the best policed societies, for no other motive than the pleasure, the sheer pleasure of committing them? The joys of brutality, the joys of evil for its own sake. There are many such crimes that no one remembers. The newspapers mention them briefly, if at all, in veiled language. And the reader forgets before the next morning what should be a sobering lesson that would make him think. A few crimes attain a kind of adventitious notoriety. One thinks of Loeb and Leopold in Chicago, of Harman in Germany, Vache in France, the Princess Belgioso in Italy, and a few others. Some of you may remember the well-known cannibal of Washington, D.C., Albert Fish. He was fond of children, so fond of them that he kidnapped and ate about 15 of them, after first mutilating and torturing them in various ways. He was captured in 1935, and since Earl Warren was not on the Supreme Court at that time, he was executed. Creatures like that are produced in much larger numbers than you would like to believe. Biologically, you can explain them as examples of either atavism or degeneration, but you dare not ignore them if you are going to understand the nature of the world in which you live. For if you do not understand Gilles de Rais, the Marquis de Sade, Loeb and Leopold, Hermann, Fish and their kind, you cannot understand Bolsheviks. Let me conclude with one further comment on what I have tried to say. When the Bolsheviks, jackals, in the press and radio snarl at us, they usually hiss, racist and white supremacist. Let me make it clear, therefore, that I am not arguing for the superiority of the white race. I am asking a question, a biological question. Have we, the men of the West, who are a small minority among the world's inhabitants, who are the sole creators of a civilization whose technology gives us absolute mastery of the world if we want it, we whose Christian civilization, for all its defects, is in comparison with others as superior morally as it is technologically, have we lost the will to live? That is a question that any observer must ask when he sees the incredible spectacle of a great nation taxing itself to nourish cannibals, draining away its economic blood to arm Bolsheviks, tolerating in its own midst the systematic breeding with its own money of degeneracy and crime. Have our minds become so befuddled by the hypocritical jabbering of unhuman invaders and the babbling of our own fools that we have lost even the instinct of self-preservation? If indeed we have, then, by the irrevocable law of nature, we have become, like the dinosaurs, the dodos, and the mountain gorillas, biologically obsolete, and the world will soon know us no more.
And now, for a little relief from all that scratchy and hissy recording from the days of yesteryear, this is the Dubliners and Stockton's Wing playing together. I heard the song in Ireland, and some said it was about a small, mischievous child, and some said it was about a small, mischievous child's ghost. So maybe we're stepping back a month to Halloween. Anyway, this is called Cúnla.
That's rapping the door to me. Who is that there that's rapping the door to me? Who is that there that's rapping the door to me? Only myself is Cúnla. Cúnla dear, don't come any nearer me. Cúnla dear, don't come any nearer me. Cúnla dear, don't come any nearer me. Maybe you shouldn't say Cúnla. Who is that there that's tapping the window pane? Who is that there that's tapping the window pane? Who is that there that's tapping the window pane? Only myself is Cúnla. Cúnla dear, don't come any nearer me. Cúnla dear, don't come any nearer me. Cúnla dear, don't come any nearer me. Maybe you shouldn't say Cúnla. Who is that there that's climbing the stairs to me? Who is that there that's climbing the stairs to me? Who is that there that's climbing the stairs to me? Only myself says Cúnla. Cúnla dear, don't come any nearer me. Cúnla dear, don't come any nearer me. Cúnla dear, don't come any nearer me. Maybe you shouldn't say Cúnla. That's pulling the blankets down. Who is that there that's pulling the blankets down? Who is that there that's pulling the blankets down? Only myself says Cúnla. Cúnla dear, don't come any nearer me. Cúnla dear, don't come any nearer me. Cúnla dear, don't come any nearer me. Maybe you shouldn't say Cúnla. Who is that there that's tickling the toes of me? Who is that there that's tickling the toes of me? Who is that there that's tickling the toes of me? Only myself says Cúnla. Cúnla dear, don't come any nearer me. Cúnla dear, don't come any nearer me. Cúnla dear, don't come any nearer me. Maybe you shouldn't say Cúnla. Who is that there that's tickling the toes of me? Who is that there that's tickling the toes of me? Who is that there that's tickling the toes of me? Only myself says Cúnla. Cúnla dear, don't come any nearer me. Cúnla dear, don't come any nearer me. Cúnla dear, don't come any nearer me. Maybe you shouldn't say Cúnla. Who is that there? that's making the fire for me? Who is that there that's making the fire for me? Who is that there that's making the fire for me? Only myself, says Coonla. Coonla dear, don't come any nearer me. Coonla dear, don't come any nearer me. Coonla dear, don't come any nearer me. Yet maybe I shouldn't, says Coonla.
Comrades, tonight I'm going to talk about Guillaume Fay's The Battle of Europe. And this is a Michael O'Meara book, and apparently this is a critique of Fay's ideas. Fay is the author that wrote about anachrofuturism and many other essays dealing with the situation in Europe and primarily what's going on in France. This is an essay dealing with the pros and cons of Fay's ideas. It starts out with an overview of what's going on in Europe and the situation there with Muslims and how it's really been taken over in a lot of places, particularly in the West. And you have also a lot of economic collapse going on. Now, it used to be that the European right really saw Americanism as the main problem, but Fay tends to see Americanization as adversarial, but not the real problem. He tends to see Islam as the problem, and in that sense, he has fallen into a kind of modernization. And he's been radical enough about the Muslims that he's actually been sued by the French government for inciting hatred. Because he's so concerned about the Muslims, Fay has actually taken on a pro-Zionist stance. From reading these critiques, it's hard to tell if he really believes in this stance or if he's taking it simply for pragmatic reasons. O'Meara criticizes this view because O'Meara says, well, how do you explain the dominance of the cultural and the financial power wielded by primarily the liberal sectarian Jewish factor? How do you really explain certain things like the impossibility of criticizing these factors? But Fay really, I think really for the sake of pragmatism, in my view, really wants to sever ties with anti-Semitism. He says that may have been a problem once, but now the Muslims are really the issue. And he really tends to look at the universality of Christianity, and he's very concerned with that. The author of this critique says that's true, but you also have to look at the fact that Christianity has been many things at many times, and it hasn't always been this sort of universal and liberal as it is now. Now, the author says that with this attitude, Fay may move into the mainstream and the ideas may be electable, but what kind of nationalism would this promote? O'Meara really tends to critique this idea by saying that, well, yes, the Muslims are a symptom, but without the Americanization that's going on in Europe, the symptom would not be the case. Now, Faye is against the UE, and he's against NATO, but he doesn't come out very strongly for any of these or against any of these factors. He tends to have a lot of interesting ideas about the economy of France. He tends to think that the French need to tighten their belts and work more because the French only have a 4-day work week. And he says they need to stop paying their executives so much and they need to take shorter vacations because they have 5 weeks of vacation a year. He also comes down very hard on Islam and all the welfare that they give in France. They're very good to all the immigrants, both legal and illegal. And they're also very tolerant of the Muslim religion, and he sees that as a draw to Muslim immigrants, which of course it is. Now, the author says that the primary problem with Faye is that even though he believes in an alliance with Russia and he believes in Euro-Siberia and an autocratic zone, he doesn't really support this strongly enough because he's too friendly with Israel, because he tends to see, as I've said, Islam as the main problem. And so Omera doesn't really see him as revolutionary. He sees him as more maintaining a certain degree of status quo. I didn't realize this book would be such a criticism of Faye, but I think if you read it carefully, there's some validity in these criticisms, even though Omera does acknowledge that the situation is very complicated, and I can also understand Faye's desire to be pragmatic. But the strongest criticism that Omera has is that Faye has not really understood what Omera is calling the Namos of 1945 and the significance of that and how all these other symptoms, Islamic immigrants or other immigrants into Europe and other factors, all stem from the American hegemony after or, you know, as a result of 1945. It's really a brilliant essay. And anything from Arctos Books is really fantastic. And this is a type of book that, if you enjoy reading these kind of essays, I have to say the first few chapters were telling me things that basically I already know, because anybody who would be paying attention to the situation in Europe knows what's going on over there in terms of certainly Western Europe being really overrun. At first it was kind of a slow read because it wasn't telling me anything new, but then as these interesting critiques, as I got more into it, I really found myself enjoying it. Thank you for listening. You know, I'm always trying to find interesting books, and certainly what's going on abroad, they always produce such excellent and thoughtful literature that it's really a pleasure to share this with you. So thank you for listening.
Right. I know this week's podcast is a little heavy on the other commentators and light on my own dulcet tones, which some of you complain about, but that's mostly because of the length of the Revelo Oliver piece, which I apologize for. But I say again, it's important for you guys to come to know our own past. And we have a lot of new people coming into the movement these days as more and more white people, especially white males, but more women as well, wake up to the fact that there isn't going to be any American dream for them and their families, and that they have been betrayed. They stumble onto the internet, and they end up on Stormfront and VNN looking for answers they ain't going to find there, because the Northwest Front is the only outfit that has any real answers, and we're banned from mention on those boards out of fear that the new people will realize that we're the only one with answers. And when you're packing a moving van and preparing for Northwest migration, you don't have much time to play around on the internet. As to any serious instruction on racial ideology or history, there isn't any. The Northwest Front has our recommended reading list, and we have the White Book, But most groups don't even have that. They don't even have a manual of any kind, never mind one that somebody bothers to update every few years. The result is that I need to spend a lot of my time in telling people where we've been so that they'll know where we're going. Speaking of white racial history, here's an interesting little factoid for you. Who actually thought up the idea of an independent white republic in the Pacific Northwest? Who's really the father of the Northwest Imperative? Is it me? Nope. Robert Miles? Nope. Pastor Richard Butler? Nope. Nor is it the Order Men, or Sheldon Emery, or even the so-called State of Jefferson back in 1941. The man who first had the idea of making a separate white nation out of the Pacific Northwest was former Vice President of the United States Aaron Burr back in 1807, who wanted to set up another nation west of the Mississippi to kind of counterbalance the one headquartered in Washington, D.C., using land that was part of the Louisiana Purchase, as it was called then, and in territory that had just been surveyed by Lewis and Clark. It was a kind of harebrained scheme, and it never really got off the ground, and Burr was tried for treason twice, and acquitted both times. But just so you know, this idea of an independent nation in the Northwest is not something new in American history. It's almost as old as the United States itself. Now, speaking of history, I'm now going to do something that I do every Thanksgiving. I'm going to tell you the true story of Thanksgiving, not the liberal horseshit that the media and the Democrat Party ladle out like pumpkin pie. Now, it is certainly true that the pilgrims must have given thanks for good harvests and health and freedom to worship as they chose, but they did so every Sunday. In fact, they were so devoted to freedom of religion that they made everybody exercise that freedom by legally forcing everybody to go to church on pain of fines and jail and the pillory. Anyway, this is the first recorded actual Thanksgiving proclamation. You will note that the real first Thanksgiving in the Massachusetts colony was proclaimed 56 years after the landing at Plymouth Rock, and so it had nothing to do with the pilgrims. Note also that it was in June, which actually makes a lot more sense for a feast or a holiday than a cold Massachusetts November. Finally, note that the first Thanksgiving was proclaimed to celebrate a white military victory over the Indians in what was called King Philip's War, not to invite them all to sit around the same table over turkey and cranberry sauce. Now, the present third Thursday in November holiday originated as a propaganda stunt proclaimed by Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War, in order to distract the North's attention from the fact that at the time the Union was getting its ass kicked by the Confederate Army. Anyway, here is the first Thanksgiving in the words of the people who lived it. The Holy God, having by a long and continual series of his afflictive dispensations in and by the present war with the heathen natives of this land, written and brought to pass bitter things against his own covenant people in this wilderness, so that we evidently discern that in the midst of his judgments he hath remembered mercy, with many singular intimations of his fatherly compassion and regard, reserving many of our towns from desolation threatened and attempted by the enemy, and giving us especially of late with many of our confederates many signal advantages against them, without such disadvantage to ourselves as formerly we have been sensible of. If it be the Lord's mercy that we are not consumed, it certainly bespeaks our positive thankfulness when our enemies are in any measure disappointed or destroyed, and fearing the Lord should take notice under so many intimations of his returning mercy, we should be found an insensible people, as not standing before him with thanksgiving, as well as lading him with our complaints in the time of pressing afflictions. The council has thought meet to appoint and set apart the 29th day of this instant June as a day of solemn thanksgiving and praise to God for such his goodness and favor, many particulars of which mercy might be instanced. But we doubt not those who are sensible of God's afflictions have been as diligent to espy him returning to us, and that the Lord may behold us as a people offering praise, and thereby glorifying him. The council doth commend it to the respective ministers, elders, and people of this jurisdiction, solemnly and seriously to keep the same, beseeching that being persuaded by the mercies of God we may all, even this whole people, offer up our bodies and souls as a living and acceptable service unto God by Jesus Christ. Signed this 20th day of June, 1676, Boston. All that happy-crappy liberal fantasy about white people in steeple-crown hats and black-and-white dresses sitting down at wooden picnic tables to a big feast of turkey and pumpkin pie and cranberry sauce with the Indians? Never happened. It's a liberal lie, a rewriting of history. To our ancestors, Indians were vermin, dangerous vermin. The war to which the Colonial Council referred in the proclamation lasted almost 2 years, and it wiped out an estimated 15% of the white population of New England. Many outlying settlements in western Massachusetts and Maine were destroyed or abandoned and never rebuilt. In view of what the Indians did, both before and after they killed white people, one can understand why the colonists wanted to show their thanks for escaping. Oh, and by the way, King Philip's War also gave white America its first military hero, Captain Benjamin Church, who founded a company of scouts and shock troops called the Rangers, who are part of the U.S. Army to this day. Well, here's a kind of a Puritan-type song in order to celebrate Thanksgiving. This is a hymn written by the German Protestant leader Martin Luther. In German, the title is Einem festem Berg ist unser Gott, which means a mighty fortress is our God. That name sounds familiar for some reason. I seem to have heard that someplace before. Well, never mind, it'll come to me. I know it seems like I've spent most of this episode just reading things into the mic, but again, there is a reason for that. Certain articles and ideas I need to both print and speak into digital audio to make sure that these ideas and polemics get circulated to the widest possible audience, such as the Bill White section I began with, and to make certain that certain concepts and comments are preserved and available in both hard copy and in digital audio. I'll probably be reprinting the Bill White tirade in Northwest Observer as well, because we have a lot of readers who either do not have internet access or who choose not to have internet access, which is a choice I often wish that I myself was able to make. But let's slow the pace down now and get all Thanksgiving-y for a bit. I obviously don't know the personal situation of each and every one of you, but my guess is it's not so good. Now let's face it, happy and prosperous people don't listen to programs like Radio Free Northwest. They just keep their muzzles jammed into the trough, inhaling all those Jew goodies. I can probably imagine the kind of problems you have, again, depending on your actual situation. Are you married with children? If so, then you're going to have one set of problems. If, like so many white men, your marriage and your family have been destroyed by America and you're all alone, you'll have another set of problems. And if you're a woman, you'll have a third set of problems. But all of these problems will have one root cause. The fact that this country no longer belongs to us, and we are ruled by evil people who do not belong here in the first place. Yeah, obviously that's an oversimplification, but you get what I'm saying. It used to be that however rough things got, America offered people one thing no other place on earth did: endless fresh starts. That is no longer true today. Once you fall below a certain level, say the inability to maintain basic rent on some freezing little trailer or apartment, then you're homeless, and once you're homeless, you're pretty much done. It is almost impossible to rise above that level ever again in this society if you're white. That can happen to anybody, you know. Even if you're still living in an actual house, which fewer and fewer normal white people are, then that means your mortgage or your rent is sky high and you've got a lot farther to fall. That wasn't very Thanksgiving-ish, was it? Okay, well, this is Obama's America in 2013, so I guess in a way it was. Look, let's forget all that and let's assume that your life seems to be on a fairly even keel right now. I'm sure you know how far you can fall and how fast, and I can understand why you're terrified of taking any risk or striking out on your own and leaving the herd. I have to admit that all this was always a lot easier for me because my family was taken away in the 70s and again in the 80s, and I always had a lot less far to fall than some of you do. But fall you will. After you finish your Thanksgiving dinner and the kids are in bed or down in the basement playing video games and the house is quiet for a bit, I want you to sit down and have a very long, clear, calm reflection on exactly what is happening in this country and what is going to happen in the future. No, I mean really. First off, how safe is it where you are? Can you hear the booga boogas or the gabble of pigeons Spanish at night? If you can hear them after dark, they're too close and you're in danger. Get the hell out of there, even if it's not to the Northwest homeland. Now, sooner or later, the weed am going to percolate that there be a white man or white peoples living at such and such an address, and ever nigger know that the old fay live in a palace and he got all kind of money in him mattress under his floor. So Jamal and the homies needs to pay that old white motherfucker a visit one night. If you remain where you are and you let yourself get elderly there, the chances are good that you will be killed in some kind of home invasion or burglary by a nigger or a Mexican or possibly a white drug addict who will probably live within a quarter mile of you and who one night just decides to come in and take whatever you have, including your life. This especially applies if you live in a previously all-white neighborhood that now has a substantial number of foreclosed homes. It has long been known that the FHA is going to buy up those foreclosures for pennies on the dollar. The federal government is about to become the country's largest landlord, and massive numbers of niggers and illegal aliens are going to be moved into white neighborhoods in order to break up red and/or Republican voting blocks and make sure the Democratic Party remains in perpetual power. Obviously, they're being a little bit quiet about that part of the agenda, but it's there if you know where to look for it. How stable is your job, really? You have to understand that unless you work directly for the federal government, you have no job security at all, and that includes working for the state or the city or the county. States, cities, and counties are the ones that are going bankrupt, in case you hadn't noticed. They're the ones that are laying off cops and essential workers. Your source of income could be gone tomorrow, especially if you work for a company or an entity that was unable to get a waiver from Obamacare from the Democrats and is going to have to start laying people off or cutting full-time employees to 29.5 hours every week in order to evade Obamacare. Now, somebody a while back mentioned truck drivers in this context. Well, if you're a truck driver, you have an out if you make sure that you're a member of the Teamsters Union. The Teamsters have an Obamacare waiver. What is your neighborhood going to be like 5, 10, 15 years from now? Once the FHA starts moving those niggers in and the whites begin to flee, a neighborhood can go black or brown almost literally overnight. Are you going to find yourself stuck with a mortgage on a house in some ghetto like as if you were in Detroit? It's happened in Detroit and Newark and Atlanta and Philadelphia and Birmingham and you name it. Once you have a black or brown majority, your whole life in that area is gone. You are a fool, let me repeat that, a fool to stay anywhere with a higher than 50% non-white population. Off your damn rocker. Come up here to the Northwest, where for all our many problems, the population is still majority white. Outside the cities, it is predominantly white, and it's going to stay so for a while. The Northwest is probably the last part of the North American continent, or at least in the continental United States, that is going to become majority non-white, even with the current degradation. And of course, if we can get our act together as a party and do something about it, it won't ever become majority non-white. Okay, I promised that I was going to be Thanksgiving-like. So, think about all this horrible stuff I've been talking about. Act like you got a couple of brain cells to rub together, get your ass in gear, and get out of where you are, and up here to the Northwest homeland. And happy Thanksgiving. Gobble, 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 gobble! And with that, our time is up. So that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.